Today on Maine Calling, politics and primary elections. The campaign season heats up. The June primary ballots are now set as the deadline passed at 5 p.m. yesterday for candidates to turn in signatures. It's down to 5 Democrats and 8 Republicans in the race for governor, and that's not counting the independent candidates. The congressional races are less crowded but still lively. Both Janet Mills and Graham Plattner have just released new ads. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we check in with State House reporters about the political campaigns and also the hot issues before the legislature right now. From Maine care to school funding, what's important to you this session? Have you made up your mind about your vote in the primary election? Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible by support from Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure with 19 locations across the state, now open in Bangor and Waterville, and Quarry Cottages at Highland Green, committed to providing low-maintenance living and dedicated to creating a community where residents are free to pursue their passions, and Bangor Savings Bank, committed to helping Northern New England communities thrive. You matter more. Bangor.com. And North Yarmouth Academy, a 2025 AP Platinum School recognized by College Board, inviting families to tour campus, shadow a student, and explore its new dormitory.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Yesterday was the deadline to submit signatures to get on the June primary ballot. Today, we're going to hear from our panel of political reporters about those who made the list. We'll also get the latest on what's going on in the Maine legislature. My guest today, Susan Cover, who is State House reporter and multimedia content producer with Spectrum News, Steve Missler, chief political correspondent with Maine Public, and Kevin Miller, Maine Public's State House correspondent. We invite you to join the conversation. Did you sign someone's petition to be on the ballot? Which races interest you? Which issues are you following in this year's legislative session? Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Welcome to all of you. We are in a new chapter of this year's political campaigns. That is because the deadline, as we just mentioned, has passed, and we know who's on the primary ballot on June 9th. And just to be clear, people running as independents are not on the June ballot. You all know that, but just to be clear for any of our listeners, we're talking about Democrats and Republicans. Susan, what do we know? Any surprises about who did not make the ballot, who did not collect enough signatures?
Well, I wouldn't say I was surprised at those who didn't make the ballot. I think most of them were people we all described as long shot candidates. And there's a threshold for making the ballot, and that's why. So I will say, though, there was a couple of surprises for me for people who did make the ballot. We now have a four-way race in the 2nd Congressional District Democratic primary. We have Paige Loud joining Joe Baldacci, Matt Dunlap, and Jordan Wood. And then David Costello kind of got in, I think, right under the wire to get in his signatures for the United States Senate Democratic primary. He's from Brunswick, and he's someone who ran against Angus King 2 years ago.
All right. Well, Kevin, even though the race has winnowed just a little bit in the race for the Blaine House, there are still a lot of candidates. What are your thoughts? I mean, what is it, 5 Democrats and 8 Republicans?
Yeah, exactly. So we have 13 candidates running for governor, as you said, eight Republicans and 5 Democrats. You know, it's interesting to look at the field. There's some similarities among the Republicans. You have a lot of folks with business experience. A lot of that's where they've been focusing on, you know, talking about themselves as job creators and, you know, of course, talking about reducing regulation and taxes. But they're all relatively mostly political newcomers or folks who maybe aren't household names. On the Democratic side, we have more people that might be more familiar, at least to the Democratic base. You have former state lawmakers and, you know, Hannah Pingree and Dr. Nirav Shah and former Senate President Troy Jackson. So, you know, you have a much more kind of established, politically established field on the Democratic side. So it's interesting. There were no surprises on the Democratic side. I think we expected everybody that got in looked like they were probably going to get in.
And again, talking about the 13 candidates, and that is just for the primary ballot. There will be more candidates on November, and including some, at least one name that is pretty well known.
Yeah, so there are a number of independents out there. Senator Rick Bennett might be the one that you're alluding to. He's a state senator. He's former Republican, former chairman of the main Republican Party,
and former Senate president. Go ahead.
And now running as an independent, though.
Yeah. So Steve Missler, former Governor Paul LePage, it looks like will go unchallenged in the 2nd District Republican primary. So he is the Republican candidate. However, there will be a primary on the Democratic side. Tell us about that and whether that helps or hurts Democrats.
Well, I'm not sure if it'll help or hurt necessarily, but I think the contest will be interesting because you have four Democrats. One is State Senator Joe Baldacci. Another is former Secretary of State Matt Dunlap. The other is Jordan Wood, who's a former congressional staffer, but who is from Maine. He actually started running for the U.S. Senate and then bowed out of that race when Jared Golden announced his retirement. So he got into the 2nd congressional district race after Jared Golden announced that he wasn't seeking re-election. And then Paige Loud, who literally got in under the wire yesterday. And I don't know a lot about her quite yet, but, you know, that's going to change, obviously, now that she's, you know, she's qualified for the ballot. And yeah, she turned in her signatures pretty close to the deadline yesterday. So there were a few of those, including David Costello, who was also mentioned as a U.S. Senate candidate. And he also turned his signatures in on deadline day.
Interesting. OK, so in the race for the Senate, for the Democrats who want to take on Susan Collins, we have two new ads, and we're going to listen to those. We're going to take them one at a time. The first is a new ad from Janet Mills, and this is an attack ad.
Did you know Graham Plattner wrote that women worried about rape need to, quote,
not get so fucked up they wind up having sex with someone they don't mean to?
It's disgusting.
Plattner wrote, to avoid rape, women should, quote,
act like an adult for sake.
Graham Plattner, seriously.
We blame the victim? That's a horrible thing to say.
Disqualifying. I have not seen this.
He's a bully.
This guy gives off a vibe.
Just no way I could vote for you.
No.
Graham Plattner, the closer you look, the worse it gets. I'm Janet Mills, and I approve this message.
All right. That's the new ad from Governor Janet Mills, who is running in the Democratic primary for Senate. And she is running against, as we just heard, Graham Plattner. His new ad is not an attack ad.
Meet Susan Collins. No, not that Susan Collins.
I care about Maine. That Susan Collins is a D.C. insider. This Susan Collins is voting for Graham Plattner. A Democrat with backbone. A veteran with courage. An oyster farmer from Sullivan, Maine. Graham knows who to fight. The billionaires. I'm Susan Collins, and
wait,
I approve...
Wait. That's my line. I'm Graham Plattner, and I approve this message because it's time we beat that Susan Collins.
All right. Susan Cover, thoughts?
Yeah. So, you know, seems just hours after we had the filing deadline for everyone to get their signatures in, we see both major candidates on the Democratic side release ads. You characterize the Mills ad as an attack ad. She is certainly going very hard at Graham Plattner for his prior social media posts. His campaign responded almost immediately saying, look, we answered all these questions in October. Graham was a different person back then. And this is really just a desperate attempt, by the governor for relevance at this point where, you know, the most recent polling shows her trailing. So, you know, that was her approach to today. And then, the Plattner ad is obviously lighthearted, kind of poking fun at Senator Susan Collins and not mentioning Janet Mills at all.
Yeah. Kevin? All right. Go ahead, Steve. You next.
No, sure. I mean, I think Sue hit on all the highlights there. I think what's interesting, too, is that you know, normally an attack ad like that is handled by political action committees because, you know, the candidate campaigns don't typically do this until maybe like late into the primary season or the general election, you don't need to because there are PACs that can do that dirty work for you. But I think it's interesting. It's a pretty sharp contrast between the two approaches at the moment. I mean, I know the Mills campaign says that the Plattner campaign went negative early because they had a short ad back in, I think, November, just questioning whether or not, Janet Mills should run again. And so they're kind of using that as a rationale to go hard against him right now. The other thing that they mentioned in their release that accompanied that ad is that they're really trying to hammer home this electability question. And, you know, because Plattner is obviously a political newcomer, he's untested, election tested, that is. And so they're really trying to make this case to the Democratic primary electorate that, you know, Janet Mills is proven, tested, has won statewide election a couple of times, and is a better, safer bet in the primary. That's part of their message, and that's part of the reason why I think that they're using going through the this attack approach 13 weeks before the primary election.
Kevin.
Yeah, so I think we always try to kind of read the tea leaves on things like this, but I think it's hard not to look at these ads and the way they've come out as kind of also summarizing the way the campaigns feel about how things are going. So the Mills campaign is going hard after Plattner because there have been multiple polls out now that show that she's trailing Plattner. And, you know, we can have a discussion about how accurate those polls are. You know, one showed Plattner up by 30-some points, another up by 7 points, but it seems pretty clear that everybody thinks Plattner is leading. So they're going after Plattner really hard, like Steve said, doing something that maybe outside groups would normally do with an attack ad. So it's almost they're trying to catch up, whereas Plattner, he's focusing on Susan Collins. He's not even talking at all about Janet Mills. So it's kind of a confidence. I take it as like a bit of a show of confidence on the Plattner side, like, we're leading. We're just going to focus on the general election, not even talk about the primary at this point.
One thing that strikes me, even though the ads are so different, is that both of them feature women. Susan Cover, is that a coincidence?
I don't think so. And it's interesting because I feel like Governor Mills in the last week or so has reached out to women not once but twice. She is proposing some changes to the budget. And the thing that they highlighted the most was a $6 million permanent fund for victims of crime, you know, particularly women victims of crime. And then this ad, features suburban women, you know, standing in their dining rooms, really showing a lot of disgust toward the comments that Graham Plattner made years ago. So I think it's definitely an attempt, by the Mills administration to shore up what I think she sees as a natural base of female support. And then the Plattner ad, you know, was kind of playful and definitely an appeal to women who support him as well.
Yeah. All right. So you mentioned what's going on right now in Augusta. So I want to pivot a little bit to what's going on in the legislature and just generally speaking with state government. Steve, I'll turn to you first. There is a movement to, and I know every time we talk about what races are ranked choice voting and which are not, but there is a movement to expand in which races we can use ranked choice voting. And the Attorney General has come out with a statement about this. Bring us up to speed.
Sure. So when voters approved ranked choice voting via referendum in 2016, it was originally supposed to be for all elections in Maine, governor, congressional, legislative, and et cetera, at least statewide elections. But there's a constitutional problem with that law. And so that constitutional issue led to a law court opinion in 2017 that effectively said that, you know, you can use this system of ranking candidates in primaries and in other races other than the gubernatorial races in the general election. You can still use it in the primary, but in the general election, you can't use it. It likely violates the Constitution and also legislative races. So there have been numerous attempts over the years since then to try to change that. But the only way to get a constitutional amendment would get a would require a supermajority in the legislature, and they just haven't been able to muster the votes to make that happen because Republicans are almost unanimous in their opposition to ranked choice voting. Now there's this bill that's slowly making its way through the legislature that aims to resolve this problem in statutorily by making a bunch of wordsmithing changes. And so that bill is parked in the legislature right now. And then the legislature went out and asked the law court, the same law court that issued that advisory opinion in 2017, saying this thing likely violates the state constitution, and saying, hey, look, what about this other bill? Can this fix the problem? So they're asking for the court to issue a solemn occasion or, you know, take a solemn occasion and issue an advisory opinion. And based on that opinion, they'll make a decision about whether to enact this bill and make it law, or at least send it to Governor Janet Mills. Now, enter Attorney General Fry, who came in and basically wrote a brief arguing that this legislative solution to this constitutional problem just doesn't pass muster. And he basically argues that in his brief that this law is basically makes a bunch of cosmetic changes, but it doesn't address the fundamental problem with ranked choice voting, which is how the votes are tabulated and how the thing actually works. And so that was a little bit of a surprise because I think Democrats in general are supportive of ranked choice voting, and Aaron Fry is a Democrat, but he came out with this opinion that I think is, I would imagine that the law court is going to take it into, you know, strong consideration because it is from the state's top lawyer.
All right. Well, thanks for that. I'm going to go, Kevin, to Jay Allison, who wrote on Facebook, investigate and prosecute MaineCare fraud. You've been reporting on this. For the Republican Party, this is a major issue in the legislature. What do we know about where there is and isn't MaineCare fraud in Maine and whether it's being investigated properly?
Yeah, so this is definitely an issue that the Republicans have been focusing on throughout the legislative session. And even before that, they've been focusing on this for several years. But this year, every time they hold a press conference here at the State House, this is almost guaranteed to be their top topic.
Top topic.
It's interesting that you have to differentiate between fraud and maybe some, you know, bureaucratic problems. And that's, you know, a distinction that I think some of the Democrats are making. There is a federal investigation and Maine cut off funding to one MaineCare provider because of suspicions of fraud. And so that case is out there. Then there's this references to $46 million in potential improper payments that the state made in another area of MaineCare. The feds are looking into that. At this point, it's been regarded as improper payments, not necessarily fraud, but Republicans are really kind of combining those things together. As for the investigations, you know, the state says they have a robust system for looking into, the Bills administration says they have a robust system for looking into MaineCare fraud and payments. And when there are frauds, it gets referred to the Attorney General's office and then eventually up to the feds. The Republicans are saying this is not adequate. It's obvious that something is going wrong. More needs to be done. They see this as a really kind of ripe potential political issue this year. And certainly with the help of President Trump, who's been focusing on this issue on the national level. And Maine keeps coming up over and over again when President Trump talks about it, when Dr. Mehmet Oz, the head of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, he frequently mentions Maine in the context of what we're seeing in California, Minnesota, and New York. So this is definitely a ripe political issue this year.
All right. And Susan, I want to turn to you to talk about what's going on with what's referred to as indigent legal services. And this is basically representative defense attorneys for people who are in the court system who cannot afford a lawyer on their own. I understand the whole system has run out of money.
Yeah, so just about a week ago, we all got an email from the head of public defense services saying, we don't have any more money to pay these attorneys who, as you said, are representing low-income clients. There was a bill sitting on the House calendar for about a week that proposed to fund $13 million as an emergency. The next day, the House took it up, passed it with strong bipartisan support, sent it down to the Senate. It's on the Senate calendar today, and I expect that that will be signed. And the governor said to take it to her desk. You know, this has been an issue for a lot of years now. I asked Representative Amy Coon, who's a Democrat in the legislature on the Judiciary Committee, you know, why is this always a continual struggle? And she said she really believes that they have made great strides in both developing a permanent public defense system where we have state-paid attorneys to work alongside these private attorneys who are the ones who are at risk of not getting paid at the moment. And so she said, you know, if you look a year ago, there were 1,100 people sitting in jail who did not have an attorney. And she said, now that number is down to fewer than 200. So she's, you know, really encouraging continued support for this system and thinks that we may be past the worst of what's been a really rocky road.
All right. And before we go to a break, I want to bring up one more issue, which is there's a lot of talk about redoing the state's school funding formula. It seems as though there's a lot of support for that. I'll go back to you, Susan. Do you think that will happen?
Well, it's hard to say. They certainly made a compelling case that districts with a lot of children who are low income should get more money than districts in wealthier parts of the state. But this is a very complicated school funding formula. And the last time I checked, this bill had about a $40 million price tag attached to it. So we're coming to the end of session, and what gets funded and what doesn't is what, you know, where the story is really going to lie.
All right. Well, we are talking with State House reporters Susan Cover, Kevin Miller, and Steve Missler. What are your questions for them? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we're discussing candidates for the upcoming primary election and the latest from the Maine legislature. Joining me, Kevin Miller, who is Maine Public State House correspondent, Susan Cover, State House reporter and multimedia content producer with Spectrum News, and Steve Missler, chief political correspondent with Maine Public. We invite you to join the conversation. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Find us on Facebook or Instagram or call 1-800-399-3566. We were talking about issues before the legislature, some of the hotter issues this year, and I want to sort of wrap that up a little bit. Steve, I'm going to turn back to you and talk about, well, I guess this is about for the legislature, talking about the campaigns, is we're hearing a lot about artificial intelligence. We've had Maine Calling programs on how we can spot and not spot video that's been manipulated. What can you tell us about what you've seen so far this campaign season?
Excuse me, I'm sorry. Yeah, I think, well, I can say that AI is definitely being used in ads. We saw earlier this year, actually, there was an ad from this National Republican group that used an actual AI generated likeness of Governor Janet Mills to attack her. It was clearly fake. You could see that it was a fake thing, but there's other concerns about the use of impersonating voices. And there's actually a bill in the legislature that would require political campaigns that produce ads and messaging to disclose the use of AI. And so several states have taken a very similar step and pass these laws because of this technology that can be very deceiving if you're, you know, not paying very close attention, and even if you are in some cases. In fact, today, the ad that we played earlier in the program from Governor Janet Mills attacking Graham Plattner, there's this speculation online that it was the voice was an AI-generated voice to impersonate Plattner's sort of gravelly delivery. It turns out that that's not the case. The campaign told me that that's actually a human being doing that, but it just sort of underscores the problem that there's just a lot of distrust out there and a lot of suspicion about the use of AI in these ads. And in some ways, maybe that's a good thing because people are on the lookout for it, but it also, it generated this whole thread on social media that Mills was actually using this to, you know, to impersonate her rival's voice. But, you know, it turns out that's not the case. But anyway, that bill is making its way through the Maine legislature. And of course, Governor Mills would have a say in whether it becomes law. if it actually reaches her desk. This, I think it's received preliminary support in the House. I'm not sure about the Senate, though.
And we do have an email from a listener. Kevin writes, am I the only one who noticed the Mills ad employing a Graham Plattner sound alike? For what it's worth, I'm only listening to, on the radio. I have not seen the ad, so maybe it was more apparent to me. But Susan, it was apparent.
Well, yeah, although upon, you know, first listening, you're kind of really wondering. I mean, obviously, Graham Plattner didn't read aloud the social media posts he made 10 years ago. So you figure the voice had to come from somewhere. He does have a very distinctive voice. And, you know, whether it's AI generated or a voice actor, in general, I think it doesn't really change the impact of, you know, the ad itself, which is to, you know, highlight past messages that women would probably find pretty disturbing.
Kevin, last time we all talked, we were talking about a proposal that Governor Mills had, which is these $300 affordability rebate checks. Are those still, is that idea still floating around?
Well, it's still floating around. It doesn't seem like it's floating very high, I guess I'd say. The governor did include that as part of her initial budget proposal. It was about a $200 million plus. He wants to take that money out of the rainy day fund from the state and send them out to, I think it was 750,000 Maine residents. It got a pretty lukewarm reception right from the beginning from some of the Democratic leaders. They didn't come out and they didn't embrace it. They didn't reject it outright. The Republicans just said, no way. This is not the way. We're not going to support this. There are other ways to give money back to Mainers, which is mostly through the tax code. All this is kind of tied up in the Appropriations Committee, which is the state legislature's budget committee right now. But it doesn't seem like it's in pretty good shape right now. And the governor, we asked her about it last week, and she's kind of holding the line, saying, you know, cost of groceries going up, cost of heating oil, everything else is going up. This is a way to give money back. But at this point, it looks like the legislature might be looking at other things. But things could change in the next couple of weeks.
We're going to go to Aaron calling from Westbrook. Hi, Aaron. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. I've been really invested in the governor's race because it honestly feels like right now governors are on the front lines of protecting our constitutional rights and pushing back on federal overreach. And it's not really theoretical anymore. It's real. And part of that, too, is having, for me, a Democratic nominee who is willing to stand up to Donald Trump and any federal pressure that threatens our communities. And so I'd love to hear the panel weigh in on how important it is for the Democratic nominee or really any gubernatorial nominee to have, you know, real hands-on experience leading state initiatives. You know, for me, the candidate that I've decided to support is Hannah Pingree, because I think the stakes right now feel incredibly high, and she's done the work, she's practical, and I have no doubt that she'll stand firm against Donald Trump and push back on any federal pressure. But at the end of the day, I think it matters that we elect someone who's actually been in the arena and who knows how to lead. And I'd be really interested to hear what you're all seeing and hearing from voters and how much that kind of experience might matter in the upcoming primary and then in the general election in the fall.
Aaron, thanks so much for your call. Steve, this is like the perennial question, right, for candidates everywhere from the lowest offices to the presidency. Do you want someone with experience or do you want someone who's an outsider?
Yeah, and I think this idea that the caller references just about, you know, how will you stand up to the Trump administration is definitely on the mind of Maine's, well, maybe even Democratic voters across the country, because I think, and you can tell that the candidates understand this too, because I think to a person, they've unveiled some sort of plan to deal with pressure from the Trump administration in some capacity. And, you know, some of the candidates are basically making their campaigns all about opposing Donald Trump and his policies. And I'm thinking of Shanna Bellows, the Secretary of State, who's actually engaged in a legal fight against the Trump administration's Department of Justice to turn over the state's voter rolls and personal information that would be contained therein. So she's really centering that that dispute in her campaign. And then the other candidates have done the same thing. I think Nirav Shah has released a plan to how to deal with you know, federal overreach. I think every single candidate has done that. So every one of them is taking that issue very seriously, because I think it's something that's very, very important to the Democratic electorate. So, you know, I guess it just depends on which of those candidates you think are going to be best equipped to do those things. And, you know, certainly Hannah Pingree has been in state government before. She also served in the Mills administration up until leaving to launch her gubernatorial run. So there's certainly a lot of experience in the field, at least in opposing Donald Trump. And, you know, again, I think that that's something that's pretty important to the Democratic primary electorate.
Aaron, thanks so much for your call. We'll move on. Let's see. We'll move to Portland and Jamie. Hi, Jamie. Go ahead.
Oh, hi, Jen. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, just briefly on a programming note, I'd suggest to get a show on polling in the near future, maybe after the next Pan-Atlantic, and I think it's UNH are the two that are referenced a lot. There'll be more probably coming in. But that being said, it's a, you know, the polls can be a lifeline in a sense. The pollsters hopefully would want to come on and explain their methods and how they go about, you know, getting their results. And so my little mark has been, as being unenrolled, you know, I can vote. And so I guess my early lead on the polls was, hey, are they including us unenrolled that now can vote in the primaries? And but it's more than that now. It's really understanding that that they're well designed. And long story short, let's do a reference here. Randy Billings did a really good article on the UNH poll, and you know, there are some qualifications to that poll that he referenced in a 2 week ago article or so, maybe 3 weeks.
Yeah, so, Jamie, I really appreciate it, and you're right. It's been a little while since we've had pollsters on the program, but even the most recently, when we have had them, they are talking about the difficulty that they are having because they don't do polling the way they used to. People don't have landline telephones anymore, and it's really hard for them to reflect the demographics of the voters, and they will admit that. Susan, given that, as a reporter, as a political reporter, how seriously do you take polling results today when they come out compared to how you might have 5 or 10 years ago?
Well, I definitely take them with a large grain of salt. As you mentioned, now people may be, you know, taking surveys on their phones or not picking up their cell phone when someone's calling because they don't recognize the number. You know, like you said, we're not all sitting by our landlines anymore. And I think it's important to remember also heading into a primary, it seems particularly difficult to poll who shows up to vote in a primary. It's kind of an odd time of year to vote in June. Obviously, a lot of people are just now tuning in to get into, you know, these races and learn more about all the candidates. But I think it's important, you know, for anyone who reads a story about a poll, you know, what's the margin of error? How many people were polled? If you want to dig into the crosstabs and see if a certain group is overrepresented in this particular poll that might have changed it in a certain way in favor of a candidate, that's important to know too. And, you know, the biggest caveat of all is that polls are, you know, simply a reflection of a point in time, you know, a few days in February, this is what people said, but they're not meant to be predictive of election results.
All right. The candidates themselves use them, as we were talking about with the ads, right, Steve? I mean, they are something that's really interesting to those of us who are following campaigns, but the campaigns are using them differently than we are as potential voters.
Yeah, and I think the other thing, too, is that the campaigns actually have money to invest in quality polling. I'm not saying that to disparage the public polls that were mentioned, the UNH Survey Center poll, which is a very good firm, and you know has been doing presidential primary polling in New Hampshire for decades, and same with the Pan Atlantic, which is a local firm and here in Maine. You know, I'm not saying that to disparage them in any way, but the candidate campaigns often have access to very granular level polling that you know is sometimes better than what we see publicly. The problem is that they don't want to share bad information about their campaign, so we don't ever see that. And they always want to spin the good information that they share, which is often incomplete. So, I mean, from the media, from my perspective as a reporter, I see these polls that come out and they are just a piece of information that we sort of look at skeptically. We do here at Maine Public anyway, we try to resist the urge to center polls in our reporting, as meaning like that's not the lead thing in a story. It may be a piece of context in a story. And I think that's really important, at least for me, because people just get this, I think, have a bad or sometimes they're just like they view polls as predictions. And I think that that's a problem because that's not the tool that they're designed to be used for. They're, again, as Susan said, a measurement of a point in time. And, you know, sampling matters hugely. The margin of error matters. I mean, there were some people who were running out with results from one of the UNH polls and it had a sample size of like a couple hundred people. Well, the margin of error on something like that, it makes it almost useless. So I just think that, you know, we just generally have to be very, very clear, that these things are, they're tools to measure things in a campaign, but they are not the end all be all about what the race is, where it's headed.
We are talking about Maine politics on Maine Calling. We're going to take another quick break. Join the conversation. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we are talking about politics. We're talking about issues before state legislators and the latest on the many campaigns and candidates seeking office. My guests are Maine Public's two political reporters, Steve Missler and Kevin Miller, and Susan Cover with Spectrum News. Share your comments and questions. If you're quick, you can send a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram or give us a call. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Jan, who's calling from Ellsworth. Hi, Jan. Go ahead.
Hey, Jennifer. How are you today?
Good.
So just a quick question. I was listening on my ride into a job site, and my question is, when Shanna Bellow's name came up as a gubernatorial candidate, she's also the Secretary of the State, who's one of her primary functions is to oversee our elections. How is that not a conflict of interest?
Thank you, Jan, for that question. Kevin, Jan's not the first person to ask that question.
No, this comes up anytime you see a Secretary of State running for higher office. And the short answer is there's no law preventing it. There's nothing that says a Secretary of State can't run for office at the same time as they're overseeing the elections division. We saw this back, I think it was in 2012. Kind of backing up, we've heard a lot of the criticism initially against Secretary of State Bellows has come from Republicans. But I'd go back to look back to 2012 when the Republican Secretary of State, Charlie Summers, was also running for the U.S. Senate. So this is an issue that comes up year after year. And kind of the answer you get is that they're obviously not supposed to make any decisions that would personally affect them. But I think this criticism is probably going to keep on coming up because with Secretary Bellows, we do see she takes positions as a Secretary of State on issues, whether it's going after the Trump administration on something or, responding to a criticism. And then frequently her campaign kind of promotes that or puts it out several days later or even hours afterwards. So, you know, this is a criticism that comes with anybody who's in public office. It could be against the governor, Senator Collins. Of course, they're going to do things in their public office that their campaigns are then going to use.
Jan, thank you for your call. An email here from Moira. So much to talk about this morning, but one constituency that is consistently left off the agenda is children. Representative Lori Gramlich has sponsored LD 1893, which would establish an independent child advocate to provide oversight of the state's children's services and promote children's best interests. Maine trails every other New England state and a growing number of states across the country in establishing these independent voices for children. The bill is in workshop with the HHS committee today. And she wants to know if this is a proposal that you all are following and you'd be interested to hear your thoughts. So are any of you following this proposal to have an independent child advocate?
Yeah, I mean, I think anything, excuse me again, I think anything that has to do with child welfare is a hot topic right now because of, you know, recent child deaths that were where the children were in the state's care or oversight. And this is, you know, there's a lot of different proposals that are aimed at trying to resolve this problem, and which is not unique to the state of Maine, by the way. It's a problem in a lot of other states as well. I mean, it was even there's been a couple of attempts to separate out child welfare services or the Office of Family and Dependents from the Department of Health and Human Services. The argument being that that DHHS is just too large of an agency to properly care for, you know, to have this other sub agency underneath it, and you know that there's just too many roadblocks or bureaucratic blocks to, you know, getting anything done. Those proposals have been defeated, you know, pretty handily, almost, and on a bipartisan basis in some cases, because there's, you know, child welfare services is so interconnected to other programs within DHHS that the argument is that you just keep them there. I mean, if certainly, you know, a child welfare advocate, I mean, we already have a child welfare ombudsman, which monitors the state's progress and how it handles child welfare cases. So I'm not quite sure if this other proposal is meant to complement that or not, but it's certainly something that we will be tracking if it makes it past the committee level.
We'll go to George, who's calling from Fairfield. Hi, George, go ahead.
Yes, thanks. Thanks for taking this question because it pertains to Shenavella's, and I understand you discussed it a little already, but I think that this is a something that's kind of outside the normal politics going on, which is that Shen is not polling nearly as well as one would have expected for someone who's already run for governor and is so experienced at that level in Augusta. And I'm following also this Maine wire. I call it the Maine quagmire. It's two individuals, two guys who are just kind of dogging various Democrats on behalf of the Trump administration. And they're really taking a personalized fix against Shenavella's, almost to the point that she probably has some, you know, something either like a slander or a defamation case against them. It's really almost perverted. And it's, I think it's skewing. They're using this viral negativity to kind of skew the public perception right now. I think that's unfair to her. So it's a two-part question about what can be done to kind of stabilize things regarding Shenavella's, but also what can be done about these just two individuals that are acting in such a derogatory, divisive way to all of us, really.
All right. Yeah. Which of you wants to take this one on?
Well, I mean, I could give it a shot on and just address the, you know, the attacks from the Maine wire, which, I mean, honestly, they have a free, that's protected speech. And I think it's just up to people to make a decision about whether or not the methods that they use is something that they agree with. And I think that that's where it begins and ends. I think that's the extent of what anybody can do about it is just people can either be turned off by it and ignore it or, write to the organization that sponsors that organization, the Maine Policy Institute, if it's that bothersome. So, you know, I don't think there's any way to stop it. It's just something that's just the way they do things. I mean, I understand the attack. I mean, I understand the point about the attacks. They are increasingly personal. There was one point, I think last year, where they used AI to transform Shenavella's into some manifestation of Joseph Stalin. You know what I mean? And they pass that around and they're selling T-shirts and that sort of thing. It's just the kind of operation that they are. And, again, nothing that can be done about it. And, you know, I think we addressed the other issue about the conflict with Secretary Bellows. And I think, that's a question that she'll probably be asked in the primary in a debate forum or something like that. Because I think, Democrats might, some of her Democratic rivals may actually bring it up. So, and again, as Kevin mentioned earlier, that's not a new concern when the Secretary of State is running for higher office.
Kevin.
Yeah, and it seems like Secretary of State Bellows has been really in the sights of Republicans for some time now, especially after she tried to keep President Donald Trump off the ballot in Maine, that the Republican ire against her was really intense at the time, and it really has never let up. and certainly the Maine Wire and other conservative outlets are really kind of going after her. She, I guess, you know, her house was swatted. You know, she says she's been doxxed several times now. So these are real world impacts when, you know, when groups are focusing so much on her. But her campaign is, you know, kind of responded in kind, and they often use that as a way to say, look, this is a way of showing that we're having an impact, that we're making waves, and we're going after President Trump. So that's been her response to the attacks.
George, thanks for your call. Susan, before we wrap up the hour, I want to talk to you about one of Maine's towering political figures, George Mitchell. He has, really been someone many people in the state of Maine are very proud to call their own. The architect of the Good Friday Peace Accord, former Senate Minority Leader, founded the Mitchell Scholars Program. But now his name has surfaced in the Epstein files. It's unclear in what way. And I know that you've covered this a little bit about how Senator Mitchell himself seems to be taking his name or agreeing to take his name off of things. And what do we know and what do we not know? And what are you hearing as people discuss what's unfolding?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, Senator Mitchell did voluntarily take his name off serving as a board member of the Mitchell Institute. And I went up to Waterville a couple weeks ago to talk to a woman whose child goes to what was formerly called the George J. Mitchell School. It's an elementary school in Waterville, which is where Mitchell grew up. And she really led the charge for his name to be removed from the school, just saying that even though we don't know to what extent, Senator Mitchell had any dealings at all with Jeffrey Epstein, that she just didn't feel it was appropriate that he had in any way associated with him, that his name should remain on a school. You know, I think we've all gotten the statements from Senator Mitchell's spokesman who said, you know, he in no way did anything inappropriate with minors. And the minute he knew that Epstein had been convicted in Florida, he took steps to distance himself from him, avoiding phone calls and emails and declining invitations to get together. So, there's a lot we don't know. Obviously, we don't have all of the Epstein files yet. And I think, maybe as more information comes out, we'll learn more. But you're right, Senator Mitchell is someone that, a lot of people in Maine have really looked up for a very long time.
Yeah, and it's just so interesting that all of this is happening before more information is even known. It seems on some level a bit premature.
It does. And the parent I spoke to said she doesn't want to libel anyone. She doesn't want to make any false claims, but she just didn't feel good about having her kindergartner go to a school that was named after someone who appeared in the Epstein files. So I think as we sift through, the fallout from all of the people whose names turn up in the files, we're going to have to decide where to draw the line. And, maybe this will turn around and Senator Mitchell will come to know that he really had nothing to do at all with any of this. But we just don't know at this point.
All right. Thanks for addressing that. It's hard to talk about when we know so little. We have time, I think, to squeeze in one more question. Here's an email from Michael. How much revenue is the state medical cannabis space would be vaporized by the Ann Graham Amendment to LD 1847? So what is going on in the state medical cannabis space? Susan, I see you smiling. You know the story.
I know a little bit of it. Maybe Kevin will bail me out if I get too far over my skis. But Representative Graham's bill would require testing and tracking of medical marijuana in the same way that recreational marijuana is tested and tracked. It's surprising to a lot of people that in the medical marijuana cannabis field, the products are not required to be tested to the same level as they are for recreational. So, but folks in that field are very concerned about new legislation that would require them, cost them money for testing and tracking and labeling requirements. So that's where that's at.
I think you did a good job wrapping that up. And our email obviously concerned about the bill. Thank you all so much for being here. Susan Cover, the State House reporter and multimedia content producer for Spectrum News. Steve Missler, chief political correspondent with Maine Public. And Kevin Miller, Maine Public State House correspondent. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. And tomorrow on the program, we're going to talk about adulting and what young people face as they navigate adulthood. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.